It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear the latest views on Wisconsin politics with the results of today's Marquette Law School poll.
First, a look at the underground economy of urban America. Our next guest is a self-described rogue sociologist who takes a first-hand look at the lives of people who live on the fringes of the economy, including drug dealers, prostitutes, and gang members.
Sudhir Venkatesh joins us now. He's a sociology professor at Columbia University. He studied Chicago in his books Gang Leader for a Day and Off the Books. New York is the subject of his newest work, Floating City, a rogue sociologist lost and found in New York's underground economy. Sudhir, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
A lot of what we hear about urban America from academics, from the media, comes in terms of numbers and data. You take an ethnographic approach, firsthand conversations, interactions with real people. Why is it important, do you think, to tell these stories?
I think the two are both part of sociology's tradition and they need to complement each other. My focus tends to be on trying to step inside someone's shoes, trying to get their sense of the world looking out. So in relationship to something like the underground economy, we may want to know from an outsider standpoint how many people are working and what are the social costs to society. But we may also want to know, why are they doing it? Do they have other choices? What led them there? And so that those kinds of questions, the why questions, are tough to do unless you spend some time with people and get to know their worldview.
A big part of what you've studied in Chicago and now New York involves illegal activity, or at best gray areas oftentimes, that I wouldn't expect people to want to talk to a stranger about. How hard is it to get, say, a drug dealer, a prostitute, to open up about their lives and answer those why questions you just mentioned?
It takes some time. The book Gang Leader for a Day took about 7 years. This one took a little more than 10 years. So a little patience is required, and
a lot of successes
and failures along the way, to be sure.
How do you get entry? How do you get somebody to start talking to you? And how often do you have the door closed in your face, literally or figuratively?
Quite literally, probably 8 out of the 10 times you're getting people are telling you no. And as you go up the income ladder, the wealthier people are, the more successful they can hide their underground economies from a researcher like me. I found that there's a very simple strategy that seems to work, and that is telling people simply what the research question is, because most people are fascinated by the questions that you're asking. And in my case, just, you know, what motivated you, sir or madam, to stay in this, and is a question that they're asking themselves. So in a way, you become a kind of not a therapist, but someone who listens to them over time, and a relationship forms over the years.
People deep down, a lot of them at least, want to talk.
I think so. Carl Jung has a wonderful saying that the desire to reveal is much stronger than the desire to conceal. And there's a sense in which people who work in this world are invisible to us, and that means that their stories really don't ever get told. And I think people like to see themselves in the stories that they tell about themselves, not only the statistics that an outsider might use to capture where they are at a point in time.
We'll get into some of the stories in just a few moments. But as I mentioned, you started in Chicago. Now you're in New York. What were some of the biggest differences, maybe surprising differences, from one city to the other?
Recognizing that stereotypes always, especially about cities, always will ring partly untrue than true, one of the things I found out in Chicago is that people love their station in life. People love their neighborhood, their community. And you tended to receive a funny look if you thought you were better than your neighbors and you wanted to do something that involved getting out of your neighborhood and so on. In New York, it was just the opposite. I discovered, yes, neighborhoods matter, but everyone was searching. Everyone was trying to cross the boundaries, make connections, find people unlike themselves, and not only just because they were tourists in their own city, but because they defined their success as people by the newness of their encounter, by the thing that other people weren't doing in their neighborhood. So when I left Chicago, I expected to plop down in a neighborhood in New York and have the world open up in front of me, and yet everyone told me, and this is where the title comes from, you have to float, you got to leave, you got to move. And it took a while to be able to do that, but that, I think, is part of the secret sauce of New York.
Well, one of your main contacts was a floater extraordinaire, in a way, a man named Shine, at least for the purposes of your book. How did you meet Shine?
Curiously, I actually met Shine because I was introduced to him from a gang leader in New York. In Chicago, who was his cousin. I was having a lot of difficulty in New York, and this street gang leader in Chicago, who I complained to, often said, "You know, you should really hang out with my cousin." And he introduced me to him. And Shine was an incredible figure for me because in New York, he was trying to reinvent himself. The crack economy, many of your listeners might remember what that meant for many of our cities, was drying up in New York, and Shine had to decide, okay, I can't sell this narcotic crack cocaine. I'll have to find a new market. So instead of the African Americans in his neighborhood that he was selling to, he decided to change his identity, change his whole being, really, and go downtown into corporate America and Midtown and Wall Street and start selling drugs to a much different clientele. Okay, it's all illegal. It's still, but the idea of searching, of aspiring, and really crossing a boundary that was now easy to do was what captivated me and wanted to learn more about that.
Well, and that's one of the, I guess, mental shifts I made reading your book. We think the crack epidemic, that going down is a good thing. I think most people would agree with that. But here's a guy who viewed himself as an entrepreneur, with a market drying up and needing to diversify, to get into a new market. What did he think of himself as a bad guy for selling crack?
He didn't place that judgment on himself. And, like many people in the illegal economy who sell drugs, they often will, we can call it rationalizing, they often will say that, well, I'm not forcing anyone to buy it. And we can take that with a grain of salt. He actually thought of himself as an entrepreneur, as a business person, as someone who was trying to find a way to make money and defined himself by success. So failure was just a temporary stage in a business person's career. And in this case, one market dried up. He had resources. So what does he do? That's also where I think the pressure of New York and wanting to be on the stage, under the big lights, as it were, affected a lot of the people that I studied in my book. Even if they were invisible, they wanted the feeling of aspiring to be something bigger than themselves. And Shine certainly had that feeling.
And one of the stories you tell about Shine is seeing him lay off an employee, from the crack dealing on the corner as he's trying to pursue this new thing. I mean, if you took out the drug reference, this could be something at any American business in the country.
Yeah, I, for some of the things that he was doing, I thought I was watching an HR meeting in a large corporation, laying off, rehiring, or punishing, something like that. But with one very important difference, which is at times it can get very, very violent. So if in the morning Shine was laying off somebody but telling them, you need to move on, we don't have any work for you. In the afternoon, he could be going out and physically just beating someone up, a competitor. So the law in the underground economy is not small claims court. It's, you have to go and enforce it yourself. And it's not pleasant to do. And for me, it wasn't pleasant to watch.
And that's a common theme through your books. In these markets, these gray markets or criminal worlds, there is no legal system enforcement. You don't want to call the police. You can't go to a court. And so there's this constant negotiation. How do we regulate ourselves short of or including violence?
One of the most challenging episodes for me was watching someone who was aging out of one underground economy in New York, which is prostitution, and she was trying to figure out, what can I give back to a lot of these women, and so she took a few of them aside and said, I'm going to help you be like me, meaning I'm going to teach you how to manage women, and so you can make sure they're protected if they're going out on the streets or in the hotels. And as she's teaching them how to manage, which sounds like a kind of a mundane activity, she's telling them the secret to managing women is to making sure that all of the women that you're managing know that they're going to get beat up. I mean, it's a very kind of perverse world, because it has both the mundane aspects of it that kind of attract a sociologist who's interested in an economy, but it also has deeply unsettling parts of it as well. And they sit right next to each other all the time.
And do those aspects of it, the violence, does that seem mundane, do you think, to the people involved in it?
I wouldn't call it mundane. I would call it scripted, meaning that it's not as though they're in a wartime situation or that they're in a situation of a disaster. All the lights are turned off in the city and no one knows what's going to happen. It's that they understand the consequences of their actions. They know that if they do X, Y is going to follow, and Y sometimes might be punishment. So it can have a kind of rote or routine feeling to it, but only because there are rules there. From the outside, it's very difficult to see order. It just looks like it's chaos. People are killing each other or doing this and that. But when you're in the game, when you're there, you have a pretty good sense of what is right, what is wrong, and what you're going to be punished for if you do what's wrong.
Sudhir Venkatesh is with us. We're talking about his new book, Floating City, about the underground economy in urban America.
There's more coming up on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
We pick up our conversation now with sociologist Sudhir Venkatesh. His new book is Floating City, a rogue sociologist lost and found in New York's underground economy. Sudhir, you mentioned some of the prostitutes you talked to, hung around with to research your book. You tell the story of a group who aren't seen necessarily as desirable by the highest paying clientele. Can you describe how they lived from day to day and month to month?
Prostitution has really changed in many of the urban areas. The easiest way to describe it is that it has gone, quote unquote, indoors. So the use of the internet has created all sorts of opportunities for women to represent themselves, to get off the streets, to work in hotels, and just to meet people outside of the eyes and ears of law enforcement. It doesn't really hold for everyone. I followed a group of ethnic minorities, Latina women, who wanted to try this. So they rented an apartment. They tried to advertise themselves online. They wanted to have what they called going white. They wanted to have something that was open to mostly white and upper-income women in the city. Instead, one of them was beaten up. They couldn't make their rent. They were made fun of. They couldn't ever really make the transition from the streets to a life where they might move from $50 an hour to $500 or $1,000 or $2,000. It was a very sad story. It was an inspiring story because it was a story of resilience and courage. But it's just another reminder that if you think that things like race or ethnicity or gender or these kinds of things that are ceilings and are limitations in the legitimate economy, if you think they don't exist, it's totally not true. You can find similar kinds of patterns in the underground economy, even in something as seemingly, I don't know, chaotic or turbulent or unstructured as prostitution.
A common theme I see between the prostitutes you were just talking about and Shine, the crack dealer trying to go to selling powdered cocaine, is that they are living in poverty or an area with lots of poverty, and there's this massive gold mine that they're aspiring to. Tons of money, Wall Street money, high society money. Is that part of what inspires people that maybe there's a chance they can get out of this lower rent underground economy?
Yeah, my colleague Stephen Levitt, who wrote a lovely book called Freakonomics, has a chapter in there that featured our research called "Why Do Drug Dealers Live with Their Moms?" And it was a nice title, I thought, that attempted to put into perspective just what the drug economy is, which is that, and this holds for a lot of these other economies that I studied, which is that there's a tremendous amount of money to be made, but really you have to be that one person or two people, three people at most in an area that's all that's going to make that. There are not a lot of people that are going to earn hundreds of thousands of dollars. Most people are going to toil away. But the problem is that there are very few options available in many of the neighborhoods that we're talking about, low-income urban neighborhoods. So McDonald's is never going to get you there, but maybe this road, this illegal road, will. The other that I think it's important to recognize is that if we're looking and trying to understand why these men and women are engaged in the illegal trade, it's not just that chance for more money. It's also that along the way, they actually feel like they're working for themselves. They feel, you know, we may not like it or understand it, but they feel a sense of pride. They feel that they're moving. They feel that they've got something to do. They're not stuck in one place. That should tell us that if we're going to do things like form social policies to improve people's lives, we've got to take the dignity and respect part of that that effort seriously when we implement these kinds of programs.
Did you get a sense from Shine, from some of the prostitutes and their managers of empowerment? Whether you like my job or not, I'm my own boss.
Well, I did get a sense from a lot of the women who were working, particularly the women who were working and making, let's say, $1,000 per night, $500 per night as an escort or a prostitute. They would never actually even call themselves prostitutes. Many said they were therapists. Many said that they were counselors. Many said that they were performing a therapeutic function. And a lot of them would reveal that they wouldn't actually even have a sexual exchange with their client. Often it was talking, or it was kind of getting their client through an evening, or working the client through a marriage that was in difficulty. So if they're seeing themselves in that way, that tells you that they're not necessarily looking in the world as a down and out person who's just struggling to survive, that they're proud of what they do because they feel like they're actually giving something that's a service. Again, we can look at it with a lens and say it's a crime, but from their standpoint, it actually helps them feel better about themselves.
Often we think of a drug dealer or a prostitute as kind of an extra in a movie. That character, that's their role. The people you talked to didn't see themselves as that. These are people with aspirations and people who are thinking they're going to float. They're going to float out of this role into another role at some point.
I think that one of the biggest lessons that I learned as a sociologist and as a writer was to try to find in the writing ways to give dignity to people who didn't think about themselves solely as poor, down and out, victims, what have you. And I struggled with that. And it was really the people that I studied who told me what I should do. And they said, pay attention to my dreams. Pay attention to where I'm trying to go and aspire. And then it just dawned on me, they're like a character in the Odyssey. I mean, they have their own epic. They want to get out of their circumstances. They're reaching and so on. So as much as they are engaged in a criminal world, it became harder and harder for me to ignore that, because that's how they saw themselves as characters in a much bigger story, and they were waiting to see how that story turned out.
One of the stories you tell in the book is as how the world we're talking about here overlapped with that high-class, big-money world I mentioned earlier, and you found some surprising overlaps there. Can you talk about one or two of those?
Sure. We're all over the U.S. and many parts of the world, families are reliant and dependent on daycare work, for example, on people who are driving them or taking care of their kids, and that's all under the table, and home repair and so on. So a lot of the work that I saw in the book was done that was not necessarily illegal or illicit, but it was incredibly important for just the functioning of a city and the functioning of community life. We just often choose to ignore it or not really talk about it, but it's there. And it weaves together the illegitimate and the legitimate parts of society. I think that was a theme for me throughout, was just watching and observing the boundaries that we often like to make between the illegitimate economy and the legitimate economy are very thin. You know, another case was films. I mean, if you think about how films are made in a complex city like New York, yes, a lot of them are made in highly bureaucratized ways with unions and so forth. A lot of it is made on a cash basis, just on the street. A movie set will emerge, and everyone, hundreds of thousands of dollars, will be paid out in cash over the period of the shoot. One part of the story that I observed was these rich, wealthy trust fund and people who inherited trust funds who wanted to be filmmakers, they just paid everyone in cash. So it looks like it's legitimate. It looks like a legitimate movie set. It just happens to be completely off the books.
In our last minute and a half or so, what can policymakers learn as they try to tackle issues of crime and poverty from the kind of stories you tell in your books?
One of the questions I always like to ask people is in the form of a quiz. What currently is about a $75 million economy per year, and that's a conservative estimate in New York, that's illegal, and not 1 cent is being paid to the government? The answer often surprises people, and the answer is just one company. It's called Airbnb. It's just an online site where you can rent your apartment or home for a few days or a month, and that you never have to pay taxes on the income that you make. And cities are trying to clamp down on this. Now, the reason I point to this is that when we think about the underground economy, we naturally gravitate to drugs and sex and gambling. But I like to think about the underground economy as the other innovation economy, meaning that there's all sorts of ingenuity. And the sooner we realize that in this society, the sooner we'll be able to do something that's productive instead of always just criminalizing it. Across the developed world, in Latin America and Africa, 4 out of 5 jobs that are generated in most of these societies are underground. And governments are starting to realize we need venture funds. We need to extend people credit. We need to help them do this in a safe way. So I think we have to ask those kinds of questions before we first say, you know, let's criminalize, let's stomp it out. Let's look at the kind of spirit of ingenuity and innovation and creativity that exists there.
Sudhir, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Columbia University sociologist Sudhir Venkatesh. His new book, Floating City, A Rogue Sociologist Lost and Found in New York's Underground Economy.
Coming up, a look at what Wisconsin thinks about politics and politicians with today's Marquette survey results. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Later in the program, we'll talk to Steely Dan co-founder Donald Fagen. He'll talk about his life in the music business, his influences, and how he really feels about the touring life.
First, we take a look at some new poll numbers out today from Marquette University Law School.
The latest poll covers topics like the government shutdown, the 2016 presidential outlook, and Wisconsin's upcoming governor's race, which looks kind of competitive, at least according to these numbers.
Joining us now is Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll and professor of law and public policy. He's also the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
I want to start with the governor's race. Now, we're still pretty far out from that election, but the information is starting to trickle in. What did your poll find regarding Governor Walker and Democratic challenger Mary Burke?
Yeah, I think it's important to realize that we are still a year out, and Mary Burke has only been in the race for barely 3 weeks. But what we found was a very tight race. Walker led Burke 47% to 45%. That's inside the margin of error. Walker also led State Senator Kathleen Vinehout 47% to 44%, almost the same. We also tested Representative Peter Barca. Walker led there 48% to 42%. You don't see very much difference between the three different Democrats. And the race is close in all three cases. What that shows is that voters are judging this race based on their feelings towards Walker and whether they approve of him or disapprove of him, because in other questions we see that 70% said they were unable to say whether they had a favorable or unfavorable view of Mary Burke. Even more couldn't rate the other two Democrats. So what we're seeing is people bring their partisanship and, of course, the accumulation of the controversy over Act 10 and then the recall race, voters have had a lot of time to decide whether they like Walker or not, regardless of who the Democrat is.
Now, I think you've been at this a while. Do you have any sense about whether when the race is this far out that these numbers tend to see a lot of movement as you get closer and closer to the election?
Absolutely. A poll a year out is important to see how are we starting this process. But this poll has virtually nothing to do in terms of predicting where the vote will be 12 months from now. The next 12 months, we will see the governor and whoever the Democratic candidate ends up being crafting their campaign. In the case of the Democrat, introducing themselves to voters, telling them who they are, and telling them what issues are important to their campaign and why those issues matter to the voters. Those are the things that ultimately are going to be more important come November 2014. This is simply the starting point, but the starting point right now that we're seeing is that voters remain, more than a year after the recall, still pretty sharply and pretty evenly divided over Governor Walker.
Now, is this poll among adults or among likely voters?
Neither. It's registered voters.
Gotcha.
We interviewed 800 registered voters, and we interviewed them by both landline and cell phone, using live interviewers for the interview.
Well, jobs also continue to be a hot-button issue here in Wisconsin. What do Wisconsinites think about the way the state is heading right now?
We see opinion shifting in two opposite directions on this. We've been asking a question about whether people believe the state is adding jobs faster than other states, about the same as other states, or lagging behind other states. And in our new data in October, 14% say faster than other states, 37 say the same, and 41 say we're lagging behind other states. But that is a shift from July, when 48% said we were lagging behind, and fewer, just 8%, said we were adding jobs faster than other states. Now, we've had a significant advertising campaign talking up the governor's job record between the July survey and this one. But there have also been changes in the real world. So an interesting question is, how much of this is due to the advertising campaign? How much is due to real world changes? And how does that affect voters' opinions going into the ultimate race next year?
And what about some of the other big issues on the table? You know, there are some key issues like income tax cut that just recently went through. The Kenosha Casino is on the table as well. What about some of those other issues out there?
We went through a range of policies that the legislature passed and the governor signed over this last spring and summer. And we find a range. On the issue of tax cuts, voters are broadly pretty supportive of both the property tax cut and income tax cuts. Over 50% approve those, and less than 40% oppose them. School vouchers are still fairly popular. 50% approve, and 44% oppose those. But other things push against the governor and the legislature. More people oppose ending residency requirements for city and municipal workers, and 56% oppose requiring an ultrasound before an abortion. 38% support that. Finally, the governor decided not to take federal money to expand Medicaid for those just over the poverty line. That decision is opposed by 56%. 36% support that opinion. So what you see across that range of issues is some that lean in a Republican direction, but others that lean in a Democratic direction. That, again, shows why the upcoming race could be pretty malleable. Finally, on the casino, opinion is very evenly split. 41% support a casino in Kenosha, but 38% oppose. And one in five, 19%, say they haven't thought enough about it to have an opinion.
Interesting. You know, if you're Governor Walker, do you have any idea how, you know, this poll gets perceived?
Well, I think that it's not probably surprising that voters have firm and strong, well-settled views of the governor. I think so in that sense, a close race right now simply ratifies the results we've seen all year in terms of his job approval and favorability rating, where he's been a little more approved than disapproved, but only by 2 to 4 percentage points. So that would have suggested that we would be in the situation we're in now. I think the bigger issue is, over the course of 12 months, how do the candidates, and especially the Democratic candidate, introduce themselves to voters and lay out the table of issues that they think are important to voters and give voters a reason to vote for them rather than Governor Walker? And from Governor Walker's point of view, how does he present his record of achievements to voters in a way that persuades them to reelect him? I think that's really the dynamic part, and we're still a good ways off before that becomes the focus of attention for most of the public.
Now, we talked about being a ways out on the governor's race, and speaking of that, the same is true of the presidential race coming up in 2016. But you did ask some questions about that. What did you find?
Yes, because it's catnip. We just can't not ask about
you
the
presidential
ask. Race. And there is some interesting results there. When we asked Republican voters about 2016, Governor Walker was in first place with 29%. Congressman Paul Ryan was just behind him at 25. And then there was a big drop-off to Marco Rubio in third place. This is a shift from May when we first asked the question, when Walker was in third place in the mid-teens. So there has been some movement there. When we asked those same Republicans, would they like to see Walker run for president, 52% said they would, but 43% said they did not want to see him run. In contrast, for Congressman Ryan, 64% wanted him to run, 27% did not. So that's an interesting dynamic for two candidates, two politicians from just down the road from each other, both of whom have a plausible shot at a presidential campaign.
Well, Charles, interesting stuff. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School Poll and a professor of law and public policy.
In the last 40 years, there have been few bands that have shaken up the music scene quite like Steely Dan. Their blend of jazz and rock, funk, R&B led to success in the 70s. And since the band reunited, they're still touring. Just wrapped up a tour, I believe, earlier this month.
Now in a new memoir, the co-founder of the band, Donald Fagen, talks about his musical influences and gives readers a behind-the-scenes look at a recent concert tour, which is often a brutally honest account of his life on the road.
Donald Fagen joins us. He's a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee. His career includes solo albums in addition to his work with Steely Dan. His new book is called Eminent Hipsters. Donald, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
Well, let's talk about that term. First of all, Eminent Hipsters. Who are you talking about there?
Well, a hipster has many definitions, I think, depending on your age and subculture and so on. But I'm using it in this particular book just to describe certain artists or performers that I used to listen to or read when I was a kid that had an influence on me.
And Henry Mancini was one of those, and I loved reading about that. I'm a big fan of some of the same songs you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Why Henry Mancini? Talk about him a little.
Well, I think, I must have been 9 or 10 when this TV show called Peter Gunn on TV. And I think that was probably the first time a lot of people heard Henry Mancini's music. He composed this jazz score that was really a lot of people had never heard what was then called cool jazz before hearing that music on TV. And a lot of people who later became jazz fans were introduced to jazz through his music.
Well, I hadn't thought about it listening to Steely Dan in the past, but with the horn section and the different kind of chord progressions, I mean, is there a straight or at least a curvy line from the cool jazz of Henry Mancini and others to at least some of Steely Dan's music?
Well, I think, of course, as I got older, I started to listening to the perhaps more authentic music that Henry Mancini was essentially using as a model for his music. So I, heard a lot of West Coast jazz and then started listening to jazz of all kinds. So I think he was one of the influences among many.
And then you mentioned people you listened to and people you read, and you talk about growing up as a fan of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
What got you into science fiction?
I remember bought up one of those science fiction magazines. It could have been Galaxy or Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, these monthly magazines that had stories in them that people used to buy at the time.
And any favorite authors that really stuck with you?
Well, in those days, I guess now they call it the golden age of science fiction, the 50s and early 60s, and there was, there was Heinlein, Ray Bradbury, Alfred Bester, Philip K. Dick, all these terrific writers.
Now, you mentioned delving deeper into the world of jazz, hitting jazz clubs, I think in your preteen years almost. You talk about jazz clubs back then and jazz clubs now. How do they compare? How do they stack up then and now?
First of all, in those days, jazz clubs were not nearly as expensive. You could really, you know, for a few dollars, go see a whole night of jazz at the Vanguard or at a Five Spot, one of those clubs. And these days, it really costs a fortune just to see one set. So that's one thing. And, you know, in those days, it was just much more casual. You know, everyone was smoking, and it was a whole different scene. You know, the whole atmosphere was different.
It was on the margins, kind of maybe more, I don't know, outsider or transgressive or something, and now it's like an establishment?
Well, I think, you know, the music was new, first of all, and it was a great time for jazz. You had this kind of post-bop thing was happening. You had, you know, I saw Charles Mingus. I saw Coltrane, Thelonious Monk were in great periods then. I saw, and then I saw some older guys like Coleman Hawkins and Earl Hines and people like that. So it was a great sort of a jazz history lesson.
Well, tell us about the birth of the band, Steely Dan.
Well, I was going to school at Bard College in upstate New York, and I met my partner, Walter Becker, who was a student a couple years behind me, and I heard him playing guitar in this campus club, and, you know, we started writing songs together, and then eventually we ended up in Los Angeles as staff writers for a record company called ABC Dunhill. We would write songs for the artists on the label, but we weren't very good at that, so we knew we had to start a band.
It was harder to write for other people than to write for your own band?
It was for us. We were terrible pop songwriters. Our stuff sounded like ripoffs of stuff that was on the radio. It was, you know, we couldn't be original in that particular form.
But you came up with a pretty unique, I would say unique original sound as Steely Dan. What was the difference there?
Well, we had these two notebooks. One was the pop song book where we were writing songs for other people, and this other notebook we called the stuff in that book the Dynamite. And we thought, like, this was the stuff, like, we were born to write. But we knew we needed a band as a vehicle because we knew that the chords were too jazzy and the lyrics were too crazy to give to other people. We'd need our own band.
Well, as I mentioned, you did a lot of solo work between then and now. When you look back at the hits of the 70s for Steely Dan, how do you feel about them today, and how do you feel about playing them on a tour now?
I enjoy playing them. I think, you know, most of the audience is there to hear, stuff from the 70s and, you know, maybe a few more newer things. But we like to, we know that there's some fans who like to hear really deep cuts, and we play a few of those. But I think, you know, most of the fans are there because they want to hear these tunes that they remember from when they were kids or that their parents played, or their parents are there to hear those tunes. What we do is rearrange them, and we're not that strict about playing them exactly like the record, so the band does have a lot of leeway, so it's there. We make them fun to play for us, too.
I mentioned you had a Steely Dan tour this year. Last year, you had a different tour with Michael McDonald, I think, and Boz Scaggs, and
right.
A lot of your book is chronicling that. People may have an image of the glamorous rock and roll lifestyle on tour. That is not how you describe it.
No.
What is it like? It you make it sound not fun in some ways to be on tour.
Yeah. Well, touring was never a great fun thing for me. Even back when I was a kid in the 70s, it was always a bit of a grind. I think I just didn't have the constitution or the personality for it or something like that. But it doesn't get that much easier when you get older either. So I started to keep a journal every night. This was in the summer of 2012. And, you know, I sent it to this publisher, and he thought it was very funny. So it's basically a fairly realistic. It's you know, I exaggerate some things to get a laugh, but essentially it tells you how a lot of musicians think when they're on the road.
And you diagnosed yourself with acute tour disorder.
Yeah, that's right. I made that up. But it's essentially after 2 or 3 weeks on the road, you know, something goes funny in the head, you know. And I think the way you cope with it is part of what the journal is about.
Well, and you've mentioned stage fright over the years, even panic attacks. I mean, how bad does it get as you're getting up on stage? Does it interfere with your ability to go up and perform?
I don't really get panic attacks anymore. I used to in the 70s, actually, but now I don't get so much of that. But as the tour goes on and you get kind of sort of physically drained and, you know, emotionally drained, after a while, like, you know, sometimes you'll be on stage and you'll start having, you know, strange fantasies while you're singing, or you'll get kind of paranoid, that kind of thing.
So what's next on your agenda? Another Steely Dan album or some solo work? Another fun rip-roaring tour?
Well, yeah, Steely Dan was out this past summer and fall, and I think we're going to be doing some touring starting in the spring, I believe. That's what it looks like now.
All right. Well, just briefly, Deborah in Milwaukee called in and wanted to let you know you were an integral part of her childhood.
Thank you very much.
Hopefully that'll pep you up for the next time you come here to Wisconsin. All right, Donald, thank you so much for being here today.
And thank you.
That was Steely Dan co-founder Donald Fagen. We've been talking in part about his new memoir. It's called Eminent Hipsters.